Welcome to Grounded Wellness, your go-to podcast for simplified and trusted information on how to live a more non-toxic and holistic life. We're your hosts. I'm Bethany McDaniel, founder of Primally Pure, biohacking enthusiast and mom of three.
And I'm Courtney O'Connor, a holistic esthetician with over 15 years experience in the healing power of touch and holistic skincare rituals.
I am so excited to welcome today's guest, Ashley Van Houten. Ashley is a passionate advocate for health and nutrition, known for her expertise in organ meats, animal-based protein, and building muscle. As a certified health coach, author, and speaker, Ashley has dedicated her career to educating others about the benefits of nutrient-dense foods and the power of strength training. This conversation is full of insights into nourishing our bodies and redefining our relationship with food. Let's dig in. Ashley, thank you so much for traveling all the way from Canada to be here at the farm today. I'm so, so excited to have you here.
It is my pleasure, and it's long overdue. I've wanted to come for a long time, so I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
We have been in touch for so many years, and I was just telling my team, like, you have been such an amazing supporter of Primally Pure since, like, the very early days.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. I mean, everything that you're doing is so in line with the stuff that I'm passionate about and the stuff that I'm doing, too. And congratulations, by the way, just on the growth and even on doing the podcast, which I know personally is a ton of work. But I love what you're doing. And I've just been super happy to be a part of it.
Thank you. And likewise, love everything that you're doing and the message that you are putting out there into the mainstream that I think is slowly getting more and more adopted by the masses. You've been shouting this message tirelessly for so long. So cannot wait for our audience to hear your expertise on organ meats and strength training and animal-based protein and all the things. Let's go ahead and kick this off with a 2-minute elevator pitch on why more people need to adopt organ meats in their diets.
I'm not very good at 2-minute anything.
Listen,
you can cut me off anytime you want. I'm not somebody, I've learned through my career, I'm not somebody who's trying to really convince anybody of anything. I think when people are ready, they're going to come to you. So I'm not the person who's going to try to get, you know, your vegan friend to eat liver. I think that's a bridge too far. But I will say that the vast majority of us still eat animal products, and we recognize that it's an important and healthy part of our diet. And so if you are one of those people, wherever on the spectrum you are, maybe you love to eat meat, maybe you're trying to eat less, but you just recognize that it's an important part of your diet, I believe that the best way to really embody that is to eat meat in a way that is as sustainable and ethical and thoughtful and mindful and then healthy as possible. And the truth of the matter is, organ meats are the most nutrient-dense foods on the planet. They're the most bioavailable for human beings. And so if you're going to eat meat, and I think most of us should, you should be incorporating organ meats because it's good for you.
Why do you think there's so much resistance around this idea of eating organ meats, even for people who are aware of the health benefits and the nutrition?
I have so many thoughts about that. I could go in so many different directions, but I mean, there's a real historical reason why they've fallen out of favor, and I can get into detail about that if you want. I think that as a culture in North America, certainly, we are very used to our food being hyper palatable, which is a problem in itself. You know, food is meant to be enjoyed and it should taste good, but there's a difference between delicious, nourishing food and really, really hyper palatable food that makes you just kind of eat mindlessly.
And that's been artificially programmed for that purpose.
Exactly. It doesn't taste like anything that you'd ever eat in the history of humanity. Mm-hmm. So we're very used to food tasting too good, in essence, in some cases. So that's a bit of a problem. And that's sort of at worst. But at best, we're also, even those of us who are trying our best to eat healthy, we're very used to food tasting also quite bland and homogenous. So, you know, those of us who are eating our lean chicken breasts and our salmon with the skin off and just with the side of vegetables, you know, we want the food to taste really kind of basic and really kind of simple. And so anything that tastes unlike that, I think, and maybe there's an instinctive biological component too, where things that are different we see as being scary. So this is something unfamiliar. It's something new. It has a stronger taste. That's bad, right?
I think our culture in particular too loves these more bland foods. Like, if you think about other cultures and the foods that they eat, they do so many unique things with the seasonings, the spices. Like, there's so much more flavor there.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason in America,
We're kind of boring here. And that's one thing that's come out when I wrote the first book, It Takes Guts, is so many people from other cultures and even Americans who just grew up eating maybe their family's cuisine or cultural cuisine are like, this is not new to me. This is not weird to me. This is what we do.
Yeah.
So really, we're kind of in the minority to not eat these types of foods. But, you know, in my practice, working with women, coaching and helping people to find their ideal diet, I still have a lot of women who will eat meat, but they don't want to eat meat on the bone. They don't want to eat meat with skin on it. They don't want to eat dark meat because they've been told all of these things about how it's unhealthy. And it's heartbreaking because you're missing so much, not only taste-wise, but also health-wise. So I could go on.
Talk to me about the historical component that you touched on.
Yeah. So I think one of the sort of biggest pieces and why organ meats have fallen out of favor is, I mean, it really started like with the Industrial Revolution. It started with modern agricultural practices and these sort of large scale slaughterhouses and mass production of, and then harvesting of animals. When that switch started happening from, you know, local farmers and smaller butcher shops and the kind of, you know, just sort of smaller, more intimate connection to our food, it was happening on such a larger scale that it was easier to get the sort of the muscle meats, the basic cuts that we're used to. And the reality is organ meats are more sensitive. So if we're talking about liver, brain, sweetbreads, all of these delicious things that we can get into later, they tend to be harder to transport, harder to store. They're just a little bit more delicate. So it became more of a hassle to kind of get these.
Like they go bad more quickly?
Potentially, but it's even literally just the tissue. Like okay. If you think, we're probably going to get a little maybe graphic on this podcast, but if you think about what a brain is versus mm-hmm. like a hunk of steak, mm-hmm. it's literally a more delicate cut. So it just takes a little bit more care and effort and work to, and again, if you're putting them on a truck and transporting them across the country, instead of maybe getting it at the farm next door, it just became sort of more work. And so less producers or manufacturers were offering it. It became cheaper to offer this really kind of easily standardized muscle meat option. And so people were then going to big grocery stores and just buying slabs of meat from grocery store instead of maybe going to their local farm, their local butcher, establishing relationships, understanding the different cuts of meat and how to prepare them. So not only did it become less available, but people just kind of knew less about it. And then it becomes intimidating. And that was a process for me writing this book. I had to figure out how to source some of this stuff, how to cook it, how to understand it, ask questions. And it can be intimidating because it's stuff you're not used to.
Yeah. You're touching on this concept of being so disconnected from our food and from where it comes from. And as you were saying that, I was thinking about these chicken processing workshops that we used to do at Primal Pastures in the beginning. Like, before we had a facility to process the chickens at, we were doing this all by hand, like my family and I in the backyard. And this was very new for me. Like I did not grow up with, you know, sure. with a farm or any type of farming background. And so it was weird in the beginning, like being a part of the processing process mm-hmm. of these chickens. But then once I did it, it gave me this whole new appreciation for the animals. Yeah. For the process and just for the ability to eat meat in general. And so we noticed that we were getting so much out of having this deeper connection to our food. And we started offering these processing workshops to the community, and people would come out and be a part of processing their chickens. And they would go through every step in the process, from slitting the neck, which is actually the most humane way mm-hmm. to kill a chicken, to the defeathering process, to pulling out the organs. And then they would go home with this bird that they processed themselves. Most, that's not the norm, obviously. Like most people kind of want to ignore that part and just the whole process of like a live animal becoming food on your plate. In our society today, don't really want to think about how that happens, everything that happens from point A to point B. Yeah. And same with a lot of different foods. I think we're just really disconnected. And so when we think about the realities of it, for most people who aren't used to doing that, it can feel really intimidating or uncomfortable. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we have to allow space for things to be intimidating and uncomfortable and still okay and good and the right thing to do in a lot of cases. I don't think there are too many people who love the idea of killing animals to eat them. Like, in their hearts, they're not pumped about the idea of death.
It's not exciting. Yeah.
It's not great. And, you know, one of the things in writing this book about organ meats, I spoke with a lot of farmers. I also connected with a lot of hunters, which ended up being quite an audience for me because they're individuals who are very connected to the food that they are sourcing and providing for their families. And they also are already deeply bought into the idea of making use of the entire animal. And they tend to be some of the most obviously respectful and understanding of the process because they understand how difficult and unpleasant and uncomfortable it can be. And I think, again, because of modern times and technology and how we can be so connected to so many of the processes that make our life run, that we are just increasingly uncomfortable with facing anything that is unpleasant, right? And it's lovely and wonderful that we live in a modern time where we can be so comfortable a lot of the time.
It's a luxury.
But it's only a luxury for so long until we run into some of the problems that we're facing with the sort of modern food industry. It's becoming increasingly a problem. And if we continue to turn away from it and say, you know, modern factory farming is bad, so let's never eat animals again and let's go buy Beyond Meat. It's not an answer. It's not a well thought through answer, and it doesn't fix the problems. So I think we just need to maybe be a little bit more comfortable incrementally with facing the challenges that are inevitable with the system. You
know? Yeah. It's like getting comfortable facing these uncomfortable realities.
Yeah.
I always think of that phrase. I don't know where it comes from, but like civilized beyond common sense.
I like it. I don't know where that came from, but I like it.
I think that that's true on a lot of levels for our world today.
Yeah.
Let's back up a little bit. How did you get involved in the world of health and wellness?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've always, from a young age, and maybe this is just, I had brothers and I was a kid in the 90s. And I think that there was like a real cultural thing at that time with like, that was the era of like Arnold Schwarzenegger and like American Gladiators and just like muscles and overt strength. And for some reason, I just bought into it at a really early age. I was always really fascinated with human capacity to be strong and to really physically express themselves. I, you know, not being much of an athlete growing up, I was always so interested in athletics and like what the human body was capable of. So I always was just into muscles. That was never something that I had to get my head around as a woman. I always liked muscles on other people and I liked muscles on myself. And so I was always in the gym. You know, as soon as I kind of became a teenager, I was figuring these things out. And it really was kind of this like parallel progression of, as I was exploring my own kind of physical interests and nutrition and all of that stuff, I was kind of trying to learn about it in a professional sense and sort of marry the two. So eventually I did get into, you know, editorial and publishing and writing for some health magazines and things like that. And I was really getting exposed to a lot of different nutritional methodologies and training methodologies. And so, and I, you know, dabbled in a lot of things. I consider myself a little bit more of a generalist than sort of a specific expert in anything, except maybe organ meats.
Yeah, I would say you're an expert in organ meats.
Just because there's not too many of us really, but, you know, and I got into, like, I was into competitive bodybuilding for a while. I found CrossFit when that was really in its heyday. And that was kind of a moment for me because it really showed me what, like, quote unquote, normal women could accomplish, because, you know, we're not that old, but when I was younger, people weren't talking about women being super strong or even being interested in that kind of stuff. It was really very niche, much less so now. If you're in the fitness world, you see a lot of very strong women doing really impressive things, but that's really recent. And so I just kind of always loved it. And so as I was learning for myself and trying to just kind of explore that for my own interests, I was, you know, on hosting a number of podcasts and then eventually finding my own and writing for magazines. And then I was coaching and then writing cookbooks. It's all just been this sort of I'm trying to make a living doing the stuff that I like would be doing for free. So it's pretty awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And what inspired you to write your first cookbook?
Yeah. So the cookbook, so the first cookbook, It Takes Guts, is the nose to tail organ meat cookbook. And
how many cookbooks out there are there like that? Well, focus on just organ meats.
Interestingly enough, so I was doing some research, obviously, before I wrote this book and thinking, like, does this exist?
Yeah.
And in what capacity? There's not a ton. And most of them tend to be older. So, like, that really kind of old school, like
ancestral.
Well, even more
mindset.
Like classic French
Okay.
or like Italian cooking. So, but it's hilarious because I have a bunch of these at home, and you know, there'll be like these tiny little hardbound books that are absolutely out of print now, but the recipe will just be like, acquire a rabbit brain and then put it and then sous vide. Like, it's just so beyond the average person is gonna kind of be able to get
this out of reach.
Yeah. And so I'm like, okay, so that's not really accessible for most people. And then, yeah, there were a couple more modern ones, some of the bigger names that have written a couple, but they again tend to be from really accomplished professional chefs. And they, I think that they speak more to people who are already really comfortable in that world. And what I wanted to do was write something that was really accessible to the average and novice, you know, home chef, which is myself. I have no background in this stuff whatsoever. And I didn't grow up eating organ meats, by the way, so we could talk about that too. But a large part of the book is really kind of hand-holding and really trying to do this in as unintimidating a way as possible. So I do talk a lot about the history and the cultural aspects of organ meats, all the different, you know, people all over the world who have always made use of the entire animal and why that's important and how they do it. I break down every organ and the best sort of ways to prep it, the most popular ways to prepare and cook it, the health benefits of each. So I really want people to just sort of feel educated and feel like they kind of understand it before they dip their toe in. And then almost all the recipes, I have a couple guest chefs and some recipes that were submitted that are from more accomplished people than myself. But generally, it's really that cliche thing of, if I can do it, you can do it. Because I was learning as I went.
Yeah. I can only imagine the amount of trial and error that must have gone into this.
Like, there was a fair bit.
Was there anything that was just a total flop, total disaster as you were going along?
Absolutely. Maybe I've just blocked them from my mind. But I mostly have funny stories of, like, I did have to establish some really cool relationships with butcher shops. Because, again, some of the stuff you'd be surprised you can find at your local grocery store and at a typical grocery store anywhere around the country. And most of us just kind of, like, our eyes just glance right off it because we're not used to looking for it. However, some of the ingredients are definitely more exotic and definitely take a little bit more work. And so I really started, like, kind of branching out to the butcher shops and asking questions. And some of these people, they eventually warmed up to me and were like, okay, this woman's, you know, interesting. But at first they're like, why is this woman coming in and asking for blood? Like, what do you want? And asking for brain and asking for interesting things. And I have, like, vivid memories of, like, there was a butcher shop truly like a 5-minute walk from my house and walking home with a bag of brains and thinking, like, this is going to make a good story someday. Like, this is kind of crazy.
How did you even know where to begin with a brain?
Well, I mean, the information exists. Like, if you do your research, you can find existing recipes, you can find information, and you can talk to, again, farmers, hunters, butchers. There are people who know this stuff, less and less so, again, in sort of North American culture. But, you know, I have friends who, you know, their families are not from North America. I have friends who are from Africa and Asia and South America and places where they're like, my grandmother has a stew recipe. Of course, there's no, you know, amounts. You're gonna have to figure it out, but I can give you some information, like, pass along. So there was some, you know, some sharing happening, but it really is just a willingness, I think, to experiment and a willingness to mess up, a willingness to try and for it not to work out. I think that food and cooking is such a low risk way to broaden your horizons and, like, try something new and experiment. If you try something and it doesn't work, you're right back where you started. if you try something and you don't like the taste of it, you literally have lost nothing.
Yeah.
But if you try it and you do like it and you do enjoy it, you potentially just opened up like an entirely new world, really, both like in the kitchen and also for your health potentially. And we're talking about organ meats. So I really encourage people. I feel like there is a lot of fear around the unknown and the new and the different. I really just encourage people to think of food just in that way of just exploration and fun and like this low risk kind of just try something new and see what happens.
Think of it as an adventure.
Exactly.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, I can think of so many people who I know who probably eat a total of like 10 different foods in rotation that maybe hasn't changed in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting thing in this culture. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you did not grow up eating this way. Tell me like how you grew up eating.
Yeah. So I think I was pretty standard American diet, honestly. Yeah. Like
standard Canadian diet.
I mean, it's all the same. I actually have American parents, so I have like a more typical, probably American upbringing in Canada than a lot of people. But, you know, I remember a lot of skim milk. I remember white bread. I remember we always ate meat. Like I remember steaks and pork chops, and I grew up on the East Coast, so I was eating seafood. So there was good and bad. There was certainly less conversation and less awareness around like processed foods and what maybe they can do, especially to children. So probably eating a bunch of crap, but I was also eating, you know, unprocessed fruits and vegetables and meat and things like that. I will say, you know, again, as a kid, I wasn't the most adventurous eater. There wasn't really opportunity, but I think there was always something in there because as soon as I became an adult and, you know, I graduated university and I moved away and I lived in a couple different countries and I lived in some big cities. And whenever I had the opportunity, I would, you know, try new cuisines, go to new restaurants. And I always wanted to get the thing on the menu that I didn't know what it was like. And if other people were like, oh man, what is that? I don't know what that is. I'm like, I'll get that. So I always did kind of approach it like this adventure. I'm like, let me just try it.
Especially if you're in a new place and like the opportunity to try something that you may never have access to again. I was the same way in college. I went to Africa for 2 months and I was so excited to try everything. We visited the Maasai tribe.
Did you get some blood?
No, I asked for it actually. Cause they, for anyone who's unfamiliar, the Maasai tribe is a tribe in Africa and they are not hunter-gatherer tribe, they're a what would you call that, pastoral tribe?
Yeah, I would say, yeah, shepherding.
Yeah. But their main food source is raw cow's milk mixed with cow's blood.
Yep.
And so I did ask them if I could try that, and they would not let me try it, which may have been a good thing. I don't know.
Well, I mean, talk about sustainable, because they're able to do this and keeping their cattle alive. I mean, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And you know, they've done studies on these tribes too about how their cholesterol and fat intake is really high because they're eating their blood and milk. But they're, of course, slimmer. They have virtually no heart disease.
Can you speak to the cholesterol myth or misconception?
There's
with meats.
I think one of the sort of the main issues around people kind of equating red meat with heart disease has come from some flawed studies. And as we know, there's a lot of instances of flawed studies in the health and nutrition community where something comes out, it has a really provocative headline like HRT for women is bad or red meat will give you heart disease. And it's really easy to hang on to that. It's like a soundbite that people remember even when those studies are later debunked, new studies come out, new information comes out. And I think with some of that study, it was really truly like study design that just kind of, it was so limited and it caused a lot of issues. Like at one point they were comparing essentially people who ate a standard American diet with meat to like strict vegetarians, which is not a one-to-one comparison at all. As we know, the standard American diet has a number of issues and meat being the least of them. And so there's, you know, the new studies that come out that show, you know, when they're trying to equate, and it's really tough to do this because you don't know what other lifestyle factors are going into the health outcomes of individuals. But, you know, meat eaters who are eating well-rounded, healthy, unprocessed diets compared to vegetarians who are doing the same, the heart disease issue basically goes away. Yeah. And then there's also the idea of cholesterol, again, being a bad word and being this like uniformly kind of scary thing. We need cholesterol. Mm-hmm. We need dietary cholesterol.
Our so brain, good for the brain.
Our mm-hmm. brains are made up of cholesterol. Mm-hmm. So we do need it. And I do know like a lot of people who eat higher animal protein tend to have maybe higher LDL and some higher cholesterol readings. And it's something to consider and be aware of in the context of the rest of your life. It's one marker that may or may not be indicative of something else. But I know tons of people who are like, yeah, every time I go to the doctor, my LDL is like slightly elevated, but every other health marker is good.
Right.
My weight is good. My fitness is good. My every other thing that I do is good.
Yeah, there's so much nuance in the cholesterol conversation.
Yeah.
And even I've heard that I'm by no means like an expert in speaking on this, but something about like the particle size of the cholesterol also yeah. matters. And there's just a lot more to it than we've been told. And the narrative has changed so much over the years too. I'm thinking like that Time magazine cover when they initially told us that to stop eating butter and eggs because of the saturated fat. And then just, I think 5 years ago or so, they published another one with like a thing of butter
Everybody
on the cover saying
yeah.
like, eat butter, it's okay now.
Yeah.
Don't forget what we told you,
yeah.
you know, 15 years ago, now it's fine.
Yep.
So yeah, that's always kind of evolving the mainstream messages on that stuff.
And I think, you know, one thing I think we were going to talk about at some point is the idea that there is no one prescriptive diet that is going to be perfect for everybody. And anybody listening, even what I'm saying, you need to take it with a bit of a grain of salt. I think anybody who is dogmatic, anybody you see on the internet who says you have to eat carnivore, you have to eat this specific way, you have to be a vegan because that's the optimal human diet, it's short-sighted, and they're probably either trying to be provocative or try to sell you something. There is a basic foundational template that is best for most human beings, and it's a really great starting point for most people. And then from there, individuals need to do the hard work and the fun and empowering work of tweaking and figuring out exactly what works for you based on maybe where you live, what your personal preferences are, what your goals are. Are you pregnant like yours truly, or are you trying to build muscle, or are you going through menopause, or are you 15? You know, like we all have to kind of make the adjustments. So I really caution people to not fall victim to somebody who is maybe popular and attention getting and looks good as their main platform. I think that it really should be more about the education component, what feels right to you, learning how to actually listen to your body. And that's not, again, a sound bite. That's like a real thing people need to learn how to do. And especially women, we have a hard time with that. But yeah, there are some universal truths, some things that we can jump off from. But
what does that basic template look like?
I believe in my work and experience, I believe that a paleo-ish approach is a really, really common sense, great starting point for most people.
I feel the exact same way about the paleo diet. And I say paleo diet, but I don't think of it as a diet. I think of it as a way of eating, because like you said, it is not overly restrictive. And it's really just going back to the basics of eating real food.
Yep.
At least that's how I see it. So I love eating paleo with an emphasis on animal-based protein. That's kind of where I've landed.
Yeah, I love that. That's literally the second book. So it's called Carnivore-ish because you got to have a snappy name. But I'm not necessarily a proponent of like strict carnivore, especially long-term. It's just that if you go to, you know, the healthy eating section of a bookstore, it's all plant-based, right? The entire thing is vegan, plant-based pictures of salads. And all I wanted was to show that you can eat a well-rounded diet that has both animal and plant products in every meal that can be focused around animal protein. And it is healthy and good for you. It's good for your family. There's nothing extreme or crazy or aggressive about it. And, you know, just the marketing job that's been done recently to equate plant-based with health is really actually impressive. It's unfortunate because I don't agree with it, but it's really been an impressive marketing plan.
It's a lot of dollars behind that movement.
It truly is. I mean, and you can look at, like, there's candy bars now, which, again, I'm not demonizing anything. I like a candy bar. But there are chocolate bars now that talk about being plant-based, and they put a little green leaf on the chocolate bar. And we are immediately thinking, okay, so this makes it healthier. Mm. It's so bizarre. And then, you know, the meat-based cookbooks are in the specialty section. It's a really strange time in food.
How do you feed your son? Because you have a 3-year-old son.
Yes.
What does his diet look like? Does he eat organ meats also?
Yeah. So it's been a really fun, and I'm sure you can say the same thing too, because it when you have kids, it now isn't just about what you want to eat. It's about what they should be eating, what you want them to eat, and then what they actually will eat, which don't always line up. I do believe that there is an element of obviously introducing things early, which helps. And I do believe that even introducing things in the womb helps. So when I was pregnant the first time, and now, again, spoiler alert, I'm 5 months pregnant again, and I ate meat throughout my entire pregnancy. I ate organ meats through my entire pregnancy. And this maybe could go down a rabbit hole if we wanted to, but, you know, I didn't stop eating a lot of the things that conventional wisdom tells you to stop eating in pregnancy. I mean,
same.
Runny eggs and pasteurized cheese and
raw liver
and all of those things. I eat all of them. You can't say for sure that that's going to help your kids like those tastes too, but there does seem to be some research that they sort of recognize and maybe prefer flavors that they're used to taking in when they were in your body.
And also via breast milk.
Breast milk as well. Yeah, that's exactly right. So I was doing all of that to kind of prep him. And then his first real foods that he ate. So I breastfed for 1.5 years until he said, I'm done, which was easy for me. But when he started being interested in food, the first thing he put in his mouth was, I think it was like a beef rib bone. And after that, I gave him some chicken liver was one of the first things. Bones was like a little bit of meat on the bone that he could kind of gnaw on. I gave him cod liver. He still loves cod liver.
My kids are obsessed with cod liver.
It's delicious. Do you do smoked cod liver?
I do the extra virgin cod liver from Rosita.
It's so delicious.
You do smoked?
I smoked.
I've never tried.
You gotta try it. I should have brought some for you. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. But
yeah,
it's so good, and he prefers it. He wants to eat cod liver, and I think it's, you know, there is an element of.
Okay, I do the oil. Are you saying actual?
The actual.
Okay, liver. I haven't tried that.
I'm going to get you some.
Okay.
It's so good. And people give me the most horrified looks. Most of my family even are like, what are you doing? This is a lot even for you. I'm like, it's so delicious. You just have to give it a try. But he doesn't know, and children don't know what's weird or extreme or gross. They don't know that, you know, liver is a stranger cut to eat than anything else. So you do have a lot of opportunity to introduce your kids to things when they're younger. And I know that there is a reality of kids do find this stage when they're in, you know, toddlerhood, where maybe they do get a little bit pickier, and there's bio individuality there too. Some kids are just going to be pickier than others. And I will say, you know, my kid doesn't love a lot of vegetables. And, you know, people listening might be like, well, duh, you're the organ meat person. You're not really like pushing vegetables too much. And that's kind of true. But we give it to him all the time. We're always giving him different things to try. We're modeling eating all of these things in front of him. And even, you know, my husband and I, this is a great example of how there's sort of a foundational principle that looks different to different people. So he is, you know, a much bigger, taller person than I am. He tends to be really lean. He needs to eat a lot to maintain his weight, like such a terrible thing for him. Anyway, he has to eat a lot. He is much more convinced about wanting to eat more vegetables than I am. So his plate is going to be a lot bigger than mine, and it's going to have a lot more vegetables. Mine does not. I'm still eating vegetables. I'm still eating fruit. I'm still eating different things. And I'm showing my son that this stuff is delicious and it's fun to try new things. And then within that framework, he's going to eat what he wants to eat. But there is that element too of like, he's not going to eat the junk food if there is no junk food for him to eat.
Right.
And it comes, you know, like everyone will say, well, what about when he goes to a friend's house? What about when he goes to school, when he gets older? There's time to navigate these things. But when they're toddlers, I don't really feel, again, I'm not a dogmatic person. I also don't feel a two-year-old needs to eat like straight sugar. I just don't think it's necessary.
You know? I feel the same way. Like, we don't need to give them these fake foods just under the premise that like they're missing out. Like they don't have like a Cheeto deficiency or a Coca-Cola deficiency. Yeah.
And you can make healthier versions of these things that are delicious. Like every birthday, I make him his own cake. That is a cake. It's not made out of carrots and, you know, sadness. It's a cake, but it's healthier. It's lower sugar. There's fewer ingredients. It probably has some added protein in it. And, you know, I know that some of these really hyper palatable, really high sugar foods, like they are drugs. They're absolutely. I fall victim to it, too. If you put some, you know, peanut butter cups in front of me, I have a hard time not eating all of them. So you do this to a two-year-old or a three-year-old, what do you expect to happen? And when they've had a taste of that, how do you expect them to go back to the cod liver or the carrot sticks or, you know, whatever? So my son, he's definitely a protein kid and he eats.
Which I think most kids are, if they're given that.
They tend to
be. I mean, my kids all have been. I think there's something instinctual in all of us that wants protein.
I think so.
And especially for kids, it's like as they're growing, you know, they need the building blocks to grow.
Yep. And, you know, he eats a lot of dairy. He loves his butter. He loves his milk. He loves his coffee. He eats a lot of sardines straight from the can. Again, he just like horrifies it.
That was one of the first things I gave my kids.
So like, you're just eating like full fish from a can. He loves it. And I'm never going to tell him that it's a weird, bizarre thing to do. I think it's amazing. And I think it helps his health. And this is something that I can't say prescriptively is, you know, this caused this, but I know that putting him in preschool and, you know, all the sickness, all the stuff that comes when you put your kid out into the world and then he comes back with all of his germs, I really think it's been minimized because of cod liver. Because when you think about like previous generations, they'd give their kids like a spoonful of cod liver every day. It's like helps with your immune system. And he eats the actual liver every week. And I think it's helped make him kind of more resilient and have a good immune system. I mean, it seems to be working.
So. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah.
I think there's this misconception that just because you're feeding your kids like different types of foods, that they're going to feel left out and that it's weird to live that way and to eat these things. But I also want my kids to grow up believing that it's okay to do things different than the general population.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yes, sometimes there may be a little bit of discomfort, but also that's okay. Like, it's okay not to follow what everyone else is doing in a lot of different areas of life. And I think food is one way to kind of teach them that at an early age. Like, you know, everyone makes different choices. These kids may eat these things and that's what they do and that's okay. We still love them. But this is how our family eats, and just kind of get them comfortable with making like different types of choices is something that I try to do for them and model that for them as well.
I love that.
What about adults who are interested in the benefits of organ meats, but nervous to dabble into it and start eating organ meats? Where would you recommend that someone starts out?
Yeah, I have a lot of answers for you because this is, of course, a very common question. I have a lot of people coming to me saying, like, I'm interested, but I didn't grow up eating this way. It's very intimidating. I don't like the taste of liver. And I know you've said that on the podcast before, so I have some advice for you,
too. I'd love to hear your advice.
I have lots of thoughts
about
it.
Because I'm still, like, this is an area that I also still need to grow in. Like, this is how I get my organ meats, is the smoothie that we're drinking.
Sure.
And I haven't ventured outside of that a whole lot.
Yeah.
And you challenge me in this area. And so I want to hear your challenges.
But
go on about what you're saying.
And good for you for finding the way that it works, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Okay, so the first and easiest step I would say to anybody who's interested is go to a restaurant and order something off the menu and have a professional make something for you. Because you would be surprised how many organ meats are on restaurant menus. Again, we just train our eyes not to look for these things, but if you go to a Mexican restaurant, there's probably a tongue taco. If you know, maybe there's menudo, there's stew with tripe. You can get pho at an Asian restaurant that has intestine in it.
Wow.
Or heart.
Does tongue have benefits outside of, because I always think of tongue as another muscle meat, but.
They all, I mean, this is the whole other, we can dive into
just
it.
All the, dive into so it. Many unique things for each
Let's
organ,
get back to that, because I can tell you about tongue, because tongue is actually probably one of my favorite cuts. So I have.
And it's pretty mild, right?
It's delicious. It's so good. If you could, there's a learning curve in the preparation because it looks like a tongue. And if you're getting like a cow tongue, it's like this big.
Mm.
So that's another, I have some stories getting my head around, you know, prepping tongue, but it's delicious. But going back to the restaurant thing, again, it's such a low risk way to experiment. You don't have to go find the organ meats. You don't have to prep them. You don't have to have them in your home. You don't have to be intimidated about trying to make them taste good. You can experience how good they can taste because a professional is doing it for you. So you can just kind of experiment and dip your toe in that way. I think that's a really great starting point. The next step is to do what you're doing and what parents have done for their children since the beginning of time, which is hide it, hide healthy stuff in the foods that they already eat. So a lot of the recipes in my book are basically nutritionally boosting foods that you already like. So burgers, sausages, meatballs, smoothies, things like that.
That is such an easy, like we do that also. We get the ground beef with the heart and the liver mixed in.
That's exactly right.
So easy.
Yep. And you can do it, and you can do it so subtly in so many other ways. I have a blood pudding. I have a savory blood pudding and a sweet blood pudding, a chocolate blood pudding, which is actually based off a really popular Italian blood pudding dish that was one of the most popular desserts that I made. And there's blood in it, which is very intimidating to people. It's so delicious. But all it does is kind of thicken and enrich the flavor of the chocolate. It's not like you're eating a blood pudding, you know, but hide it, make it subtle. And then you're just eating the foods that you're already comfortable with, but it's more nutritious. There's nothing wrong with that. You don't have to eat raw liver every day to get the benefits. You can find ways to incorporate it into your life that makes sense and is pleasant for you. Another practical tip I would say, if you are willing to kind of start sourcing and bring some stuff home and making it yourself, is to start with smaller animals. So start with, you know, poultry.
Chicken liver is a lot more palatable than beef liver.
Exactly right. Chicken.
And chicken duck, heart, so easy.
Turkey, even lamb. Lamb heart is another one of my favorite cuts. Mm. The smaller the animal, the milder it's going to taste. And if you're just trying to get comfortable with this, a chicken liver pate is going to taste much milder than like a bison or a beef liver is going to taste, right? So start
small. And that you can find at a lot of restaurants too.
Exactly. And they're inexpensive. Mm-hmm. Chicken liver, chicken hearts, things like that are very easy to find and everywhere. So I would say that. And then one other thought that is probably my sassiest answer to this question is to just kind of suck it up and eat it anyway. Because
I love that.
And it goes back to the conversation that we had earlier, where I think we're just so scared of things that are different that we don't even let ourselves try. So again, liver potentially is something that it has a strong flavor and may be intimidating, but a lot of organs are mild tasting and actually quite delicious, and they still have a ton of nutritional value, but maybe they look intimidating, or maybe just the concept of it sounds intimidating. And again, for the vast majority of us who have come to accept and understand and tolerate that an animal is dying to nourish us, it's quite arbitrary and quite silly when you kind of step back and think, like, I'm perfectly comfortable with eating this slice of this animal's muscle meat, but this other piece of the animal is this extreme and awful idea. It's like, this animal has sacrificed its life for you. You're eating a part of it already. Mm-hmm. Here's another part that actually is more nutritious. So, and you know, again, our parents have been telling us for generations and generations, eat your broccoli, eat your vegetables. It doesn't matter if it doesn't taste good. It's good for you. And sometimes we have to do things because it's good for us.
True.
So suck it up and figure it out. Find a way that tastes good. And there are so many ways to do that. You don't have to choke it down. You don't have to force it. But also just get outside of your comfort zone and just do it anyway, because it's really, really good for you.
What is the most nutrient-dense organ meat?
Yeah, so it's liver. It is liver. There is a reason why everyone talks about liver. I will just kind of caveat and say that, again, if you are somebody who is like, I've given this a try, I've tried all the different kinds of liver, I've done it, I just cannot stomach it. Again, don't shut yourself off from the organ meats, because there are a lot of other ones that are milder tasting that may not be quite the level of nutritionally dense as liver, but still are more nutritionally dense than a chicken breast or a steak, because organ meats just tend to have all the goodness that muscle meat has, but in more concentrated amounts. So if you can't do liver, try heart, try bone marrow, try sweetbreads, try gizzards, try some, just keep trying things, because you may find something that really is beneficial and delicious. But liver is the best. It has, I think it's 50 times the amount of B12 as the equivalent amount of beef, which is in itself a nutritionally dense food. It has more folate than any other food on the planet. And folate, as you know, is a really, really important thing for pregnant women.
Yeah.
It's also something that we explicitly tell pregnant women not to eat, which I find crazy. And that's something that I feel so strongly about, because I even had people tell me when I was pregnant the first time, like, aren't you worried about, you're eating liver and you're pregnant? And I'm like, it is literally nature's multivitamin. It has more vitamin A, it has more zinc, copper, iron, selenium, all of these trace minerals and vitamins that literally make our body run, that we don't think about at all until we start to feel sick. And then maybe we get some blood work and it tells us our iron is low or our vitamin D is low. Liver has so much of it that you can eat a couple ounces once or twice a month and you're getting a significant nutritional benefit.
Wow, I thought you were going to say once or twice a week, but even as little as incorporating it a few times a month will make a big difference.
Absolutely. And this is the other thing that I think people need to know, because they think, okay, well, because a lot of times the fine print of things like supplements or like greens powders and stuff like that is like, you have to be eating a ton of this to really notice the benefits. And liver and organ meats are actually the opposite. So people who are trying to eat less meat, for example, organ meats are a great option, because you can eat a few ounces of liver and you are getting your daily or more allotment of a lot of these vitamins and minerals. And
yeah, it's packs a big punch.
And your body stores it. And, and so I understand why people will say, like, liver has 200% of your iron or your vitamin A, and that's the worry. But the other thing about, like, things like vitamin A or iron toxicity, which are the two that you hear about a lot. And again, I'm not a doctor. This is not prescriptive. You need to, do your own personal sort of blood work and research on it. But it's really difficult to basically overdose on iron or vitamin D and things like that from real foods.
Yeah.
It's much more likely that that's going to occur from supplementation.
Yeah, and from synthetic forms that aren't made in combination with these other nutrients that kind of balance things out, right?
Exactly right. And it's even harder to have too much vitamin A or iron when you're eating liver, because no one's eating.
You won't be able to stomach that amount.
Yeah. Exactly. You're not going to eat.
Your body will tell you like when enough is enough, I think.
Absolutely right. So I just think that there are so many women who would benefit from eating liver compared to the very, very, very statistically tiny number of people who may experience problems. And I think it's such a disservice. And, having been pregnant now twice, and I've done a ton of research on like sort of nutrition and supplementation and all of these things. And there does seem to be, anecdotally for me personally, some correlation between the friends of mine who are very scared of animal protein and, the more nutrient dense foods, and some pretty, I think, avoidable challenges and problems that they've had. And I remember listening to, I just have to tell this story because it just like gets me so fired up. But I remember the first time I was pregnant, I really like dove deep into this stuff. Like I wanted to know everything and do everything. And I was listening to a lot of podcasts about prenatal nutrition. And I was listening to one where the nutritionists were plant-based, because I'm like, I'm going to be open-minded and I'm going to listen to everything and I'm going to hear everybody. And I remember this woman saying that, when you are pregnant, unless it's like a really, really strong, like moral or religious reason why you refuse to eat meat, you really should consider eating some animal protein when you're pregnant, because it's just so beneficial and it's so nutrient dense and your body's going to really like accept it and it's going to be helpful for your growing baby. And I'm thinking, okay, so plant-based people are saying when you're pregnant, it's important to do the right thing and take care of that growing baby. But when it's just you, whatever, just kind of, try to get by, like eat your plant-based stuff because it's the nicer, better thing to do. It was so telling.
Yeah.
But it's like when it really matters, like eat the right stuff. But when it's just you, and that goes back to like this whole other conversation we can have about women's health and fitness and how little understanding and regard we have for women's physiology and
yeah.
how we react to different things and foods and our hormonal health and all of that stuff. It's just, it was so disappointing to hear like a woman nutritionist basically say like, we don't really care about your health, but when you're pregnant, that's a different story. You should do the right thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I want to get into the conversation about women's fitness and eating animal-based protein and strength training and all of this. To round out the liver conversation, yes. What would you say to someone who's concerned about eating the liver because of this idea that the liver is a filter and therefore stores toxins?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's one I get a lot. And that's really just kind of a physiology thing. So the liver is a filter organ, but it's not a sponge. It doesn't store toxins. So basically, toxins are methylated or detoxified in the liver, and then they're sort of moved out to be excreted. Like it's, you know, it becomes urine in the kidneys, or it becomes, you know, it's excreted through sweat, or more commonly, it's stored in our fat. So, and this is the same for human beings as well as animals. So if you're eating a really, really healthy, well-sourced animal and the muscle eats healthy, the liver's going to be healthy. That's, it just doesn't store toxins. It filters them. What you do want to be concerned about if you aren't able to necessarily source the highest quality animal products, rather than being particularly worried about maybe the organs, you want to be getting leaner cuts. So maybe fewer ribeyes, and like, I like to eat the fat. I like the fat on. I like to eat, you know, the skin with the fat underneath. But like, if you're just a little more concerned about the quality, where your meat's coming from, you're better off kind of sourcing leaner cuts.
Yeah. All of our meat comes from primal pastures and pasture mm-hmm. birds. So at home I eat fatty cuts of meat all the time, but then going out, I'll order the lean stuff if I'm not sure that the animal has been grass fed.
That makes sense.
What is the importance of animal-based protein in a woman's diet?
Yeah. I mean, it's important in everyone's diet, and I think it's just,
and do organ meats have protein?
Yes. So generally speaking, most organs are going to have like a similar protein profile to like the same amount, like, you know, 4 ounces of this, 4 ounces of a muscle meat. It's going to be about the same. Some organs have higher protein content. Like I know gizzards specifically for some reason are really high protein, and they're also delicious.
Interesting.
But generally, if all you're worried about is protein and amino acids, like the amino acids that are the building blocks of our muscles, you just want protein for like your gains, you can eat your chicken breast, you can eat your, you know, steak, but the real kind of winning aspect to organ meats is that you're getting that protein and you're getting all of the vitamins and minerals and antioxidants. Like heart, for example, is really high in CoQ10, which is a really powerful antioxidant that people spend a lot of money to supplement.
Yes. With.
And it's found in high doses in heart and other organs. Like liver is really, really high in selenium, which is a trace mineral that helps reduce oxidative stress and helps improve immune function. So it's really the other stuff that makes organ meats so helpful and so useful. But going back to the women question, the protein rich diet for women, why I focus more on women is because we as a group have been taught and sort of brainwashed in a lot of cases to think it's unhealthy. And that doesn't seem to be as much of a issue for men. The fact that there's sort of gendered messaging around food anyway, I think is so ridiculous. Like the concept that some foods are inherently more feminine.
That like masculine. A salad is a girl food and steak is a man's
like
food.
Stock photos of women like smiling with low fat yogurt. And it's so ridiculous. But it exists. And you know, if you look up meat cookbooks, if you go on Amazon and look it up, it's all like black lettering and like a dude at a barbecue and, you know, a picture of a lion and like stuff like that. It's like,
I feel like that's shifting now though. Like starting to become cool for like I'm seeing videos on social media of like these beautiful women just chowing down on a steak.
It's still pretty niche. We're a little bit in a boat.
Yeah, you know? You're probably right.
And the challenge with that, and I don't, again, I'm not knocking anybody for their journey and their approach. But even that, the beautiful woman, you know, eating a raw piece of meat, even that it's not necessarily the most effective way to communicate to the audience that actually needs to see it. Because the people who are going to see that and be like, yeah, that's badass, are probably people who are kind of already bought into the idea that eating meat is good. There's a really big group still of people, and specifically women, who think that low fat is best, who think that light meals is what they need to eat better. They think they need to calorie restrict. They think that high fat red meat is going to make them unhealthy. Those people are going to see that and think, see, these meat eater people are extreme and crazy, right? And so my approach, which is definitely less viral and less provocative, has really been to try to kind of meet people where they are and just be, again, a little less dogmatic, a little less provocative, even if it gets fewer eyes on me, because I want to be accepting and inclusive and welcoming to people who, like, I just had a lot of people, individuals who've come to me through the podcast or even through coaching, who are like, I was vegan for 10 years. I was a vegetarian until 3 months ago, and I heard your podcast, and they don't feel intimidated to talk to me. They don't feel like I'm going to try to like force something extreme down their throats. No pun intended. So yes, that group is kind of growing, and the understanding of it is growing. But I think that sometimes the extreme presentation of it can actually hurt more than help. And I think sometimes we lose sight of what we're really trying to do. Like, are we trying to provoke people and shock people, or are we trying to educate people and give them options to make them,
that's,
you know,
true,
healthier?
Yeah, I could, you know, see how that someone could just dismiss that because of the shock factor alone.
Yeah.
As just being kind of another tactic.
Yeah. I mean, my hope with the cookbook, truly, and I've told people this, is like, you're interested in a meat-based diet or eating more meat, and you go on the internet and you may see some shirtless guy in a field eating raw liver, and you think, no, thank you. And then maybe like one or two steps down, you might find my book instead.
Because yeah,
it's just the sort of more accessible, realistic version of what they're also trying to do.
Yeah. I love that you bring up the calorie restriction, because I do think that that was a big thing several decades ago, and it's still having an effect on people. But I think there's such a difference between calorie restriction and like trying to either lose weight or manage your weight that way, and like, yeah, truly nourishing your body and healing your metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's this idea that like you have to restrict first in order to get to that place where you're healthy. But I would argue that you have to like balance things first, and then that you're, you know, getting healthier, losing the weight if you need to, whatever, will kind of be a natural result of that. What's your take on that?
I agree. I think it's yeah, it's often kind of the opposite. People want to just like lose weight immediately first. And I think the big thing is really setting expectations when I work with clients, that if you really want to do this the right way, there's going to be some, just reframing of expectations.
It's a long game.
How long it takes.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think some of this goes to there's the cultural aspect, the cultural side of it, where so many, the most common thing that clients come to me that they want is they want to lose fat and build muscle, and they want to do it at the same time. And lots of people will tell you that can be done. And I will tell you that while it's possible, it is for 99% of people not the fastest or most effective approach. It's kind of like you're going to be doing two things in a half-hearted way, even if you don't intend to, instead of trying to really do one thing properly with all of your focus and attention, and then sort of move into the next phase of what you're trying to do.
So what does that process look like when you're training women and setting them up for success in that way? Is it, which one comes first, the building of the muscle or the losing of the fat?
Almost exclusively building muscle first. And there's a couple of reasons for it. Unless you have a significant amount of body fat to lose, maybe that's going to be more of a part of it initially, but the vast majority of clients, that's not the issue. First of all, building muscle first is important because that's healthy skeletal muscle. You've had Gabrielle on the podcast. We know that this is important for our health to have skeletal muscle. It's going to minimize injury. It's going to minimize pain. It's going to help you live your life better. And for all of these women who are coming to me and saying, I want to look toned and look better, what happens when they lose fat without gaining muscle? They get smaller, but they still don't like the way they look, because in order for you to look toned, you have to have muscle first. And if you have spent your entire life under eating and maybe chronic cardio and not strength training and not focusing on building muscle, there's no way on earth you're going to look toned. You just aren't. And some of it's semantics. Some of it, again, is like going back to understanding our physiology. And some of it is the language that we speak and the way we talk about ourselves and the way we talk about women and how they look. And, you know, you never hear people describe men as toned.
Yeah.
You never hear people describe men as bulky. These are good or bad words that we ascribe only to women. And it causes so much fear and uncertainty. And, you know, so going back to the idea of like build muscle first, lose fat secondary. And often the fat loss will happen as you're putting more muscle on your body. Body fat is going to just sort of do its thing.
Yeah, the muscle actually helps you to lose fat.
It can help you as an organ. You also will look better at your current body fat level when you have some muscle on you, because that is that sort of universally appealing shape that everyone's going for, is kind of seeing the curves of muscles on your body. And when you have muscle, how much fat you have starts to matter a little bit less. But it also goes back to this idea, and this is something I talk about with my clients, that is, you know, because they say, I'm worried about getting bulky, right? That's a big thing.
Yeah, talk to us about the bulkiness concern that a lot of women have.
So I have a lot of thoughts about it, but one thing that's kind of coming up for me more recently, and that I kind of push back with my clients, is getting a little bit bigger so horrible? That's the worst thing you can imagine. Not losing your health, not losing your period because you're not eating anything, not, you know, losing your libido and you know, decreased fertility and all of the stuff because you're under eating. People are doing that all day long. But the idea of potentially eating a little bit more and building muscle so that you maybe have to buy a bigger pant size, there's nothing worse. And that goes back to this really problematic fitness culture that women inhabit, where it stops them from working hard enough to build the muscle that they want. It stops them from eating the nourishing foods that can really improve their health, because their number one fear is gaining weight, weighing more on the scale, getting bigger. And I just want to kind of challenge that. I'm not telling anybody that they have to be bigger bodies, or that, you know, you shouldn't worry about being overweight or whatever. I think everyone wants to look good and everyone wants to be fit.
And for anyone who's watching right now or who's listening and not watching, like, Ashley is not a bulky, like, you're...
Well,
you're,
I'm
like,
getting a little bulkier these days. I'm not generally a bulky person.
You know, you're five months pregnant, but you're not like an overly, like, you're strong and
I've
have muscle on your body.
Over a decade.
But you are not what I would call like a bulky person.
It's very true.
So it's really hard to actually get like bulky.
Well, that's the other thing I would say, is that, again, anybody who their main concern is, if I lift weights, I think I'll get bulky. It kind of just shows that you probably don't know much about strength training and weightlifting, because even men have a hard time getting bulky, and that's usually what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't happen overnight. It's not something
it's
where
not
like
happen to you by
you lift weights for a month and all of a sudden, oh no, you have too much muscle already. Like it's
absolutely
not going to happen that way.
And it is a subjective thing too, right? Because some people, depending on what your personal preference is, one person's bulky, maybe another person's perfect, and whatever. But whatever it is that you think looks really good, you will be able to regulate before you get
too far
beyond it or too big or whatever. I've had women, when I was in my more like fitness muscle building phase of life, I've had women come up to me in the gym and say like, hey, can you help me? Can you tell me what to do? Cause I really want to get strong and I want to like look muscular like you, but I don't want to get bulky. And I'm like, okay, so you don't think I'm bulky, right? And I'm like, no, of course not. And I'm like, I have been trying so hard for so long to build as much muscle as possible, and this is what I ended up with. So don't worry about it. It should be the least of your concerns is getting bulky. There are so many other things we have to do. Don't worry about getting too big.
Can you speak to the importance of building muscle and then maintaining muscle, especially as we age?
Yeah. So another reason why it really is of maybe more specific concern for women is like two parts. One being that, again, we kind of live in a culture that does not necessarily encourage or prize women who are actively trying to build muscle. And again, that is changing. But still, we do live in a culture where women, like, you have to look feminine and you should probably be smaller. And, you know, that's just sort of a concern for a lot of women growing up. So they maybe are less inclined to do the actual kinds of physical work that it takes to build real muscle.
Lifting weights,
yeah. Weight bearing exercise. And like, again, I don't want to sort of talk negatively about other fitness methodologies. If you really like Pilates, if you really like yoga, those have benefits. They're wonderful and they can help improve a lot of different things, from mobility to flexibility and even strength. But at the end of the day, again, when you have a knowledge of physiology, what it takes to actually put muscle tissue on your body is really hard work, and it involves a high level of intensity and exertion. So it doesn't necessarily mean heavy weight, because again, that's subjective. It means you, for you personally, have to work really hard and challenge your muscle appropriately. And we just aren't, we as a larger society are not necessarily encouraging women to do that. So
that can look different. That can be like high weight, low reps. It can be like low weight, high reps, or any kind of variation of that.
Basically, I mean, there are some nuance in terms of like, if you're really trying to focus on, you know, strength over hypertrophy, which is muscle building, they're not the same thing. There are some tweaks and things you can make to kind of, you know, make some changes, but
that's where working like you would come into play.
Sure.
To really get specific with your goals.
Sure. But yeah, it's like, don't get caught up in the specifics. The specific is that you need to challenge the muscle appropriately to an appropriate level, and then you need to recover properly, and you need to eat appropriately to be able to build that muscle. That's what's important. And then like the sets and reps part of it is sort of just detailed. So anyway, it's important for women to be encouraged to do this for that reason. And also because we, again, physiologically, just, we don't have as much muscle. The average man is going to walk around with a lot more muscle than we are without really working as hard. And as we know, sort of every decade that we are fortunate to continue to get older, we are, if we aren't trying to maintain it, we are going to lose skeletal muscle. And again, another part of the nutritional element for women, because we are not as likely to eat as much red meat and animal protein, and we are not as likely to really focus on building muscle, we are more at risk. And because of our hormonal profile and all of these things, we are more at risk for things like osteoporosis, which is bone density issues, and then sarcopenia, which is muscle wasting. So we start out with less, and we are at more risk to lose it as we get older as compared to men. So it sounds a little scary, but really what it means is that whatever age you're at now, let's try to build some muscle. Let's try to maintain some muscle. You can do that at any age. It's not like, oh, I didn't do it in my 20s and 30s, so what's the point? You can absolutely gain muscle at any age, and you can also maintain it. And it may get more challenging depending on what phase of life you're in, but it's absolutely possible and it's absolutely worthwhile. And it is going to help your health, and also the idea of sort of the health span versus lifespan thing. Mm-hmm. Because we all know that we can, because of modern technology, we can live a long time and not be very healthy and not enjoy a quality of life.
Yeah, modern medicine is really good at keeping us alive. And not necessarily thriving.
And enjoying our life. And I think, you know, there's a lot of, for lack of a better word, like the degradation of our body as we get older that we see as inevitable. That is, like, everybody knows that an 80-year-old is maybe going to look and perform a little differently than a 30-year-old. But this idea that you are going to be full of aches and pains, that you cannot, you know, enjoy your life and do outdoor sports and move your body and do the things you want to do as you get older, that's not true if you continue and consistently do the right things and work to maintain the level of health that you want to enjoy. And it's really so much about just trying to do the right thing consistently most of the time for the rest of your life. It's not about being perfect today. It's not about never eating something sweet or never taking a day off, or, you know, it's just about trying to do the right thing for your body most of the time, kind of forever. Which, you know,
I love that.
It's not that scary. It really isn't. I think that takes some of the pressure off, because one day of indulgence or relaxation or 1 week of going on vacation or whatever, that doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things if you've committed to these lifestyle behaviors that you just, it's just your life. It's just how you live.
I could not agree more. And for a topic that some people may think of as being kind of extreme, obviously you and I would disagree with that, but, you know, organ meats. And I think that in general, just your whole perspective is so balanced, and you have done such a good job with It Takes Guts and like finding these ancestral recipes and practices and talking to all of these different people and then making it accessible and palatable, like literally palatable for people.
I think so.
You've just done such a great job with that. So thank you so much for sharing your message today with the Grounded Wellness audience. Where can people follow along with you and buy your amazing books?
Thank you so much. It's been so lovely being here, and I really appreciate you having me on. So this has been wonderful. You can find anything you need to know on my website. It's just my name, ashleyvanhouten.com. My books are there. All the information about my coaching, my strength training programs, it's all on there. I have my own podcast. It's called Muscle Science for Women, and you can hear that anytime, anywhere you listen to podcasts. The books are anywhere that you buy books. And you can say hi to me on Instagram. I'm a millennial, so I really can't go anywhere else. I can't do TikTok. I'm stuck on Instagram. I'm stuck on it. So you can find me on Instagram at The Muscle Maven and say hi to me there. And that's it.
Amazing. Thanks, Ashley.
Thank you.